This is a special bonus episode of Judaism Unbound, every seventh Rosh Hashanah. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And today's bonus episode is a conversation with Nigel Savage. We're going to have a more official conversation with Nigel Savage in a few months, relating to the concept of Shemitah, which we've been talking about, but also about a variety of other things. He has recently taken a Shemitah of his own. He is the founder and former CEO of Hazon, the organization that houses the Shemitah Project. We spoke to Hannah Nib-Henza and Sarah Zell Young a few weeks ago about the Shemitah Project. And if you'll recall, Hazon is an organization leading a transformative movement, weaving sustainability into the fabric of Jewish life in order to create a healthier, more sustainable, and more equitable world for all. It's really known as the major or one of the major Jewish organizations devoted to the environment, to environmental sustainability and justice. And as its founder, we thought that a conversation with Nigel Savage about the Shemitah year, this every seventh year, year of reflection, year of really focusing on the land, would make a lot of sense. And so we're releasing this as a bonus episode right before Rosh Hashanah, and we're really excited to have this conversation with Nigel Savage. So just a little bit of introduction. We'll have a more extensive introduction when we do our official episode with Nigel Savage, but he is the founder of Hazon. It was founded in the year 2000. He served as the CEO for 21 years before stepping down just a couple of months ago. And I just want to mention one other thing from Nigel Savage's bio, because I think it helps you get a little bit of a taste of him. According to his bio, he is believed to be the first English Jew to have cycled across South Dakota on a recumbent bike. I take from that the possibility that there was another English Jew who cycled across South Dakota on a regular bike. We're not going to talk about that now. Instead, we are going to introduce our guest. So, Nigel Savage, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Dan, it's great to be here. Pleasure to talk with you.
It's great to be with you. So we were picturing this as a little bit of a pre-Rosh Hashanah fireside chat. And I'm just wondering if you could orient people's thinking about this particular year, which is a Shemitah year, unlike the last six and the next six.
So first of all, let me just rewind to explain how I came to be so fascinated slash obsessed by Shemitah. I actually moved to New York in 2000. That year was the Shemitah year. I don't think I knew that at the time. And Lincoln Square Synagogue had a Yom Iyun, a day of learning, on Christmas Day. And I'd sort of like just got here. I'm like, what is that? And I went and it was five or six different people all teaching about different aspects of Shemitah. And I found it totally, totally, totally fascinating. And I'm a reasonably engaged Jew. I'm a reasonably observant Jew. I'm a reasonably learned Jew. I'd never thought about it. Then it's 7 years later, Hazon is now underway. It's December of 2007. We were doing the Hazon Food Conference, and it was again the start of the Shemitah year. And by this point, I was starting to really think about it, and I did have the sense that Shemitah was kind of amazing. And I was struck that, like, nobody really thought about it. It wasn't there. Every 7 years in Israel, there is an argument about the price of vegetables and what you can eat, going back to technical Shemitah rules. And there is an argument between the Orthodox and the ultra-Orthodox that they're engaged in, or at least some of them. And everybody else is like, why is the price of vegetables gone up and what is this about? And the New York Times ran a story at the start of the Shemitah year in 2007. Afterwards, I looked this up. But I remember reading this and thinking, isn't this the same story from 7 years ago? And it was literally a different journalist, different people being quoted, and it was the identical story. And I was like, this is ridiculous. Here is this thing that you may think is obscure, but it's about relationship to land, food, community, the boundaries of community, who we care about, rest, work, debt. Every one of these is genuinely an issue in the world today. How come people aren't, you know, and at the start of the Shemitah year, many rabbis would give one sermon on the topic. But nothing deeper than that. So at the Hazon Food Conference in 2007, I was like, okay, let's try and put Shemitah on the agenda of the Jewish community by 2014, the next time around. Okay, skip forward to now and this forthcoming year. My observation is that all of Jewish life runs on Jewish time. Hanukkah is different from Yom Kippur. Shabbat is different from Tuesday. And the only thing until now of which that's not been the case has been to do with Shemitah. Why is that? So the first thing I want to say, I mean, to anybody who's listening this, but frankly, before that, to I myself, is how are you going to make this year different from the other six? Now, 7 years ago, and it was about April or May, and I was saying something somewhere, and the thought bubble in my head was, well, this is fabulous, Nige, but how is this year going to be different from you, for you? So very randomly, I decided not to buy any books. It's not as if the Torah says, please do not buy any books every 7 years. It's also not as if it's a terrible big deal. But as it happens, I like books, and I buy a lot of books. So this was a very stressful idea to me. So I started walking around the apartment, taking off the shelf books that I either hadn't read and I wanted to read, or books that I had read and wanted to read again, and wrap them in newspaper without marking them. And my idea was, if it all became too much and I was about to buy a book, I would take one of these things, rip the newspaper off and go, oh my God, I always wanted to read this book. And it was a fascinating year because A, to my surprise, I didn't buy a single book. I wouldn't have believed beforehand that that was going to be possible. I wasn't holding myself to this. I was like, let's try and do this. We'll see if it's humanly possible. But secondly, even more astonishingly, I didn't open any of those books. The pile is still there. It's like an art project in the corner of our room. And anytime somebody's coming to the apartment for the first time in the last 6 years, they're like, what are those books there? And it did two things that intuitively I'd wanted it to do and didn't know was going to be possible. Firstly, it reminded me that it was the Shemitah year. Every single time that I wanted to buy a book, I was like, oh, but I'm not going to, it's a Shemitah year. Literally, anytime I was reading the New York Times book review or somebody's da-da-da. And the second one, of course, is that it taught me that I had enough. I didn't need any more books. I got enough books here to read. So the first thing, therefore, that I would say is, it's going to be Rosh Hashanah. Okay, but it's also the start of the Shemitah year. And to each one of us, how would you like this year to be different?
How will this year be different from all other years? We don't expect that question so much on Rosh Hashanah, but I'm thrilled to put it on Rosh Hashanah. Of course, you know, that's a big Passover question. Why is this night different from all other nights? I'd love to really break down the experience you described in, I forget if you said 2000 or 2007, going to that learning festival and coming away fascinated. Coming away energized, invigorated by this Shemitah idea that was, by the sound of it, mostly unfamiliar to you. Because A, I've had that experience too. And I think that it's a relatable experience. You know, I went to Sunday school. I went to Jewish summer camp. I went to youth. I actually did a lot of those things. A lot of people did not. And a lot of our listeners did not. And I even, you know, at camp, we would talk about environmentalism to some extent. I don't think we talked about Shemitah ever. I could be forgetting, but I don't think we ever did. And I'm not saying, oh my gosh, I had such terrible institutions. That's not my message here. My message here is that for whatever set of reasons, we have not collectively constructed a Jewish society where Shemitah is like the core or one of the cores. The idea is, you know, Shabbat is one of the cores and keeping kosher is one of the cores and Rosh Hashanah and Passover and Hanukkah nowadays is sort of the core. We haven't made Shemitah that. And so my question is, what led you to walk out of that room? What did you experience in that room? Maybe whether it was that room or other rooms since then. Like, what happened to you or is still happening to you that gets you so jazzed about what Shemitah can mean for us as individuals or as a broader society?
The first question is, how come in fact most people never think about it? Why is it not on the curriculum? And I think that the answer is that we presume that this is somehow about farming. And 97% of us are not farmers. And that's the first thing that I want to unpack. Because 20 centuries ago, it was an agrarian society. And so the point of Shemitah is it's not that it's about farming. It's about life. It's about culture. It's about economics. It's about ethics. It's about values. It's about relationship to time. It's about relationship to work. And it's about relationship to community. And so as soon as we just flip that switch, that already unlocks something. For anybody who's listening, who's a rabbi, who's an educator, who leads Jewish institutions, The first thing to understand is it's not about farmers. Don't worry about that. And this leads me now to my second point. He's actually connecting to the primary texts. Shemitah is mentioned a number of times in the Torah, and in almost every case, a different word is used. Ultimately, it's Shemitah, which means release, letting go, and it's actually in context of money, letting go of debts. But it's also Shabbat Ha'aretz, Shabbat for the land. It's also Shabbat L'Adonai, a Shabbat for God. It's also Shabbat Shabbaton, some kind of quintessence of Shabbat. And this is just a brief parenthetical sideways point. I think that way too frequently in Jewish life, we just take nice texts. We take a nice text that fits with our contemporary liberal values, and then we say, oh, Jewish tradition teaches such and such. Isn't that fabulous? We agreed with it already. And I find that incredibly not interesting. I don't think it's totally intellectually honest. But even beyond that, it's like, well, if it already agrees with the liberal values I have, why do I need to be Jewish? The Shemitah texts, for me, as an Israeli might say, mamash lehefach, exactly the opposite. They're really strange. They're different from each other, and they're actually quite hard to understand, and they contradict each other. And one of the most fun things in the world, and again, I say this to any rabbi who's listening to this, any educator, you can give these texts to any group of people. They could have 3 PhDs in Talmud or not speak a word of Hebrew. They could be frankly Jewish or not Jewish. They could be 16 years old or 76 years old. And just start to read them and say, what does this mean? Do we agree with it or not? And if this was the only record that we had of 20 centuries of Jewish life, what would we infer from this of the values of the Jewish people? That conversation is an amazing conversation, and I never get bored of it. And so that is part of how I now come to be so fascinated by it. Because I think the texts are actually challenging, and I think that they open up new ways of thinking about things, and then challenges for us as individuals, and as institutions, and as a community, and in terms of the wider society.
You know, I'm thinking about that. It seems to me that one of the reasons why Shemitah is not a big deal, like you said, is because they, you know, talked about it as being about farming. And the other thing, and Lex brought this up when we were talking to Hannah and Sarah from Chazon a little while ago on the podcast, that the rabbis, the early rabbis, I think, and Lex thought, made a big mistake. Like, they really just blew it in terms of understanding that, like, there were all these holidays that they said, well, they have all kinds of ties to the land of Israel, but we're not there anymore, but we should still observe these holidays because they could potentially have all these related, similar meanings. But for whatever reason, they didn't have the vision to do that with Shemitah. And it's annoying, you know, because I feel like we have to do it. But we are missing 2,000 years worth of evolution of this Shemitah. So it seems like even just the idea of it becomes strange because it's one of these Jewish practices that we haven't really done for so long. And yet it's really no different from any of the practices that we have been doing for 2,000 years, except some rabbi 2,000 years ago made some decision that I personally think was he blew it. So number one, I guess I'm curious what you think about that whole process. And the other piece that, you know, maybe it's different altogether and maybe it's related is I'm also thinking about the you of 1999-ish, before you started Chazon. And if I recall correctly, you were like in finance or something like that. And I'm curious about how you, the Nigel Savage of 2021, would talk to the Nigel Savage of 1999 to kind of say, you should really take this seriously, and it probably means that you're going to take a year off your finance work and lose a lot of money, but you should do it anyway because...
I think Sarah and Hannah may have mentioned this, but one of the reasons that we launched the Shemitah Prizes was exactly that. The idea first came from Rabbi Nina Beth Carden, and she said, shouldn't we have some new ritual today to observe the Shemitah year? If this does matter, if it's life, how are you going to register this? You as a person, you as a family, you as an institution. Then it's suddenly very liberating that there is essentially nothing halachically, nothing in terms of Jewish traditional religious law that you're obligated to either do or not do in terms of Shemitah. So everything's wide open. One minor example. If you think of every Jewish institution that has frontage in public space, what would it be if we planted fruit trees, nut trees, apples, pears, cherries, whatever. And places have keep out signs. That's how we mark space nowadays. What would it be if you literally mail shotted every neighboring home in the lead up to the Shemitah year and said, this is the sabbatical year in Jewish life. So we want to say to you, literally, please come and help yourselves to the fruit and nuts on our fruit trees and our nut trees and stuff. Now, in one sense, that's, of course, a very literal application. But even that is just a way of opening something up, both in relationship to observing Shemitah in one sense, but actually thinking about, well, what is it? If we're trying to riff on this biblical notion, what would that be? Then think about it a different way. What would it be if Jewish institutions created a Shemitah fund and for 6 years out of seven had people who could afford it, as well as other things they were doing, put money into that? So that we could say 1 year in seven, okay, shul membership is free. Okay, JCC membership is free. Okay, we're capping all day school fees at such and such because we raised this money over a six-year period and at least 1 year in seven might be such and such. I was doing something last week and a fella said, what if for 6 years we started to create a fund and then we used it to pay bail for people who were going to go to jail because they couldn't afford bail? Now, again, suddenly we've switched gears massively. Suddenly we've made the leap, which I think is absolutely there in the primary biblical texts, because it's about values. It's about who we care about. It's about how we treat them. It's about how we share what we have with them. Jigsaw piece one. Jigsaw piece two is it's obscene that there are people who go to jail because they don't have the money for bail. And so when you suddenly put those two pieces together, holy moly, that's an interesting way to take an ancient tradition and bring it to life in ways that are consonant with its values. Now, I want to add one last thing to this, which is that a certain kind of person will say, well, that's great. Shouldn't we do it every year? Why should it be 1 year in seven? I have two things to say to that. The first one is yes, obviously, that is true. And it may be that there are certain sorts of things that in, as it were, trying it out for 1 year, we discover that we are going to proceed with it in the other six. But on the other hand, there is a marvelous specificity to Jewish time. Shabbat is only Shabbat because we have Sheshet Yemei HaMaaseh, 6 days of the week. If every day was Shabbat, it wouldn't be Shabbat. Hanukkah is Hanukkah because the other 346 days of the year, whatever it is, are not Hanukkah. And it is true that properly understood, every Jewish holiday comes to remind us of something that we should be thinking about the whole year round. The whole year round, we should be trying to be the best selves that we can be. But if we forget this period around Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, comes to remind us to sort of like repent and reflect and so on. And so I think there is actual value in allowing 1 year in seven to be different from the other six and saying this 1 year, even if we can't do certain things seven out of seven, we're going to make it different.
I remember, I don't know when it was, a few years ago, I was talking with somebody about Shemitah and I told them like, hey, you really should check out in the Mishnah. There's actually really interesting stuff in the first rabbinic text, the Mishnah about Shemitah. Like go to that tractate and read through and blah, blah, blah. And they got back to me and they're like, I couldn't find it. I couldn't find the tractate called Shemitah. And that's because there isn't one called Shemitah. It's called Shvi'it. It's called the seventh. You mentioned all the different names of Shemitah in Bible. There's different ways that it's talked about. One of the ways that the main name for it in the Mishnah, it's like a boring name on one level, like the seventh year, that's what it's called. And from my perspective, reminding us over and over again that Shemitah is sort of the grandest version of one of the key cycles of Jewish everything. Like Shemitah is the 7 year version of the 7 weeks that lead into the sacred festival of Shavuot. Shemitah is the grandest version of the 7 days that go in, or sorry, the 6 days that go into the seventh day of Shabbat. Shemitah is the grandest version. We could go down all sorts of sevens that are central to Jewish life. And our listeners know that I do this all the time because I actually think the thesis statement of Judaism is based, or maybe not the thesis statement, the way that we say anything is important Jewishly is we encode it with a seven. We put 7 days on it, or we put 7 weeks on it. We put it in the seventh month. Why do we have all these holidays in the seventh month? The new year is in the seventh month. Who has a new year in the seventh month and not the first month? We do. there's a hinting, there's like a dog whistling, not in the bad way, in the good way, that happens there. And so, but the other thing why I sent them to that thing about the Mishnah is most of that tractate is not about the seventh year. It's about the sixth year and all the stuff you have to pack in before the seventh year. And it also talks about the eighth year. It talks about the stuff surrounding it. And it very clearly gets at what you're saying, which is this is about how we structure our whole world in all the years and not just in sort of the special year that allows us to really think expansively. I would love to hear just a smidge more from you about how this Shemitah ritual can serve what I believe its purpose is. I hope you agree, as an exemplar, not just of sort of how we want to structure our society and our economics, but like how literally all of Judaism is fashioned in with these sevens.
Yeah, absolutely. All of these things, I mean, we nowadays have the right metaphor for this. All of these things are hypertext links. In the same way that we're used to going around online and clicking from something to something to something, properly understood, any time that you're looking at one of these sevens in the tradition, you're hearing echoes of all of the others. And each one of them inflects the others by teaching us a little bit about what they mean. And by the way, the only one you didn't mention is Yovel, right? Jubilee, which is the thing that's on the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia. And in a sense, it's the most fascinating because we know historically that the Shemitah year was observed 20 centuries ago. And we know it because there are Roman sources that say the Jews are so crazy, you wouldn't believe what they're doing this year. Whereas Yovel, the Jubilee, there is in fact no evidence that it was ever observed. And I think that's also very Jewish. Shabbat is in a sense ambitious, but we've kept it for 20 centuries. Counting the Omer, the seventh month, and then the Shemitah year is really ambitious, but people keep it in various ways and we can. Whereas Yovel is kind of like the messianic ideal. And what's interesting is you start to understand then when you put them together, what problem are these different things coming to solve? And one of the things that becomes clear when you put them in relationship with each other is they're coming to solve inequality. It's one of the underlying issues that clearly bothered the creator or creators of the Torah, for which in different ways, Shabbat and Shemitah and Yovel all come to respond. Shabbat, because it's equally rest for everybody, you, your maidservant, your manservant, and so on and so on. And then Shemitah, because, okay, the other 6 years, I'm a landowner and you're not, and I have more and you have less. But this year, it's like, help yourself. And then Yovel is the ultimate thing, because it's like finally taking this piece of elastic that snapped and letting it go back. So just allowing that to sit with us and understanding that that's so central to the tradition, again, at a time in human history when inequality is greater in this country and in the West than it's been for many, many decades. I want to add one last thing, which we haven't talked about, but you made reference to implicitly. Is Shabbat the end of the week or the start of the week? Now, we know that in a formal sense, it's the seventh day of the week, but in a practical sense, it's both an end and a beginning. And that's part of the arc within Shabbat. And Havdalah is kind of interesting. Is that the end of Shabbat or the start of the week? Yes. So it's really interesting that in the Torah, we have Hakel. Hakel is this ceremony during Sukkot in the eighth year. And you have to put eighth year in quote marks because the eighth year is the first year. And the king comes to the temple and reads the Torah. And the text goes out of its way, so everybody has to be there. Women, minors, like people who don't have status, who are not equal. Everybody has to be there because this is an end and a beginning. Skipping back now to us, to anybody who's listening to this, as we come now into the Jewish year, if we are a person who in any way observes Jewish time, if Rosh Hashanah for you is different than a Wednesday, if you fast on Yom Kippur, if you go to synagogue, if you light Hanukkah candles, the question is, how is the Shemitah year going to be different? And happily, the tradition has no real answer to that, right? You can think about, do I want to journal? Are there certain things I want to give up? Are there certain things I want to release? Are they physical things or are they existential things? You don't have to leap to an answer now. You can allow yourself to think about it. But the final kicker in this is that this whole year, arguably, is a time to both look back and to look forwards. This is ending a cycle that began in September of 2015, in the first year of this 7-year cycle. And then a year from now, September of 2022, Rosh Hashanah, a year from now, starts a new 7-year cycle in Jewish life. So it's an opportunity also to say, okay, September 2029, how old am I going to be? How old are my kids going to be? Where do I think I'm going to be? Where do I want to be? What have I learned in the last 7 years? What do I want to accomplish in the next 7 years? And just allowing ourselves to think in those terms is to allow Jewish tradition to speak to us in new and fresh and open and fascinating ways.
I want to just ask you in closing to fantasize a little bit in two dimensions. One is you've talked about some examples, you've talked about some smaller versions, some larger versions of examples of what this could be. But I wonder if we're talking about the Shemitah, or Lex, what year did you said the Jubilee was when?
Jubilee, we don't know when it is.
Well, right, yeah, but Lex has some.
I've made the argument that we should mark the Jubilee in the Shemitah year that's going to be 2049 to 50, because it's 49-50 on the secular calendar. And there's debate about whether it's the 49th year or the 50th year Jewishly. I think it's a good opportunity. So we got 30 years to decide. But yeah.
So let's say that we're imagining where we've gotten to with Shemitah by the year 2049. I'd love for you to like just talk big picture, big visioning about what it could be, what you would be excited if it turned into. And then, you know, maybe on the more local dimension, you yourself are about to embark on a personal Shemitah. Because you, after 21 years running Chazon, you have, I don't know if you call it retired, but you are going on to a next iteration, and you're taking this year, and you've written about and talked about how you're taking this year as a year of personal sabbatical and Shemitah. And I'm just wondering, well, and I wanted to say that we're going to check in with you in a few months from now to talk really about how that's going and what you're reflecting on. So I want to pin you down a little and try to get a little bit of fantasy version of what you're thinking so that when we check back in, we can see how it's going.
One of the things that is frankly so exciting, it was in December of 2007 at the Chazon Food Conference that I said publicly, I think we have to launch a Shemitah project to try and put Shemitah on the agenda of the Jewish community. And let's spend the next 7 years trying to do that. It is absolutely clear that there was a lot more attention and thought on Shemitah in 14-15 than there was in 7-8. I think it's really clear there is going to be a lot more this time than last time. And partly also, by the way, because COVID has given us an additional frame for all of this. Like Shemitah, it slowed things down. It slowed the economy. It, you know, did all sorts of things. So we understand this a little bit more freshly in certain ways now. So I'm pretty excited. I think that the Shemitah project is a multi-decadal project. I think we'll have a sense of its success a century or two or three from now. And I think that it's my hope, not merely that as every 7 years goes by, this becomes more and more central to Jewish life, but in particular, and as has been true of other aspects of Jewish tradition, this is too good, too rich, too interesting, and too provocative to be solely for Jews. I'd like to see a whole bunch of economists come together and discuss it. I'd like us to think about this in terms of public policy. I'd like to be able to ask, what is this adding to the contemporary conversation? How does this inflect? How does it challenge us? How does it provoke us? Not that we play it out mechanistically, X means Y, but that we marinate in these texts, these questions, these challenges, and then come out with fresh thinking and new solutions.
And your personal Shemitah, tell us a little bit of that as a closing note, or also an opening note, as you so beautifully put it, every opening also closing.
Yes. So it's really interesting. At the end of the last Shemitah year, somebody was like, what do you want to do next time? And without thinking about it, I said, I want to spend the next one in Israel. But by early last summer, summer of 2020, as I started to think about it, I realized, Nige, either you can be the CEO of Chazon, but not spend the year in Israel, or you can spend the year in Israel, but not be CEO of Chazon. I felt that I could have, you know, you could take a 3-month sabbatical and still be CEO of something, but I didn't think that was tenable for the year. Very quickly, I was like, oh, it's totally right for me to step down. I've been doing this thing for 21 years. It'll be good for me to step down. It'll be good for the organization to have a new leader. And so that was the point that I was like, okay, I'm stepping down. So one of the things that's interesting for me is having had a heavily scheduled professional life, part of what this is about for me is actually not planning, like allowing myself not to overdetermine it. Even little things have been funny. Very early on, somebody in Jerusalem sent me an invitation and said, would you come in here and teach about Shemitah? And it took me 10 days to reply to this email. Was the answer, yes, I'd be delighted? Or was the answer, no, I'm on sabbatical. I'm not going to do that. Now, in the end, in this case, I actually said yes, because I thought about it and I was like, that's ridiculous. But that place of wanting to be open to a certain piece of unknowing, and there are things that I want to do, and I really want to improve my Hebrew, and like there are various things that I do want to accomplish. But in the biggest sense, I actually don't know exactly what this year is and what it's going to be, and I'm kind of excited about that.
Not knowing is a great closing note for any conversation that we participate in. So thank you for that note. Thank you for an amazing conversation. And we're excited to reconnect with you in not too long to see how that Shemitah goes for you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this bonus episode. We hope you enjoyed this pre-Rosh Hashanah, last-minute pre-Shemitah fireside chat with Nigel Savage, one of the real founders of this new wave of Shemitah in the 21st century. We're going to close out in the same way that we try to close all our episodes, just by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And you can do so in a whole bunch of ways. There are our Facebook and Twitter and Instagram handles. All of those are Judaism Unbound. There's our website, judaismunbound.com. And there are, of course, our email addresses, dan@judaismunbound.com and lex@judaismunbound.com. We are so grateful to all of you out there for listening. Shana Tova, have a great new year. Shemitah Tova, have a great sabbatical year, a great seventh year. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.